Yeah, so thank you for inviting me and thanks for coming. My talk is going to have four parts. In the basically, a while ago, what we did was we translated concepts of which are generally used in classical mechanics, which basically yield sort of local entropy principles. We translated these concepts into the language of quantum mechanics. And so the first part, I'm going to give a brief overview, sort of schematically, algebraically, of the principles. These have a variety of applications. And the last three parts are then concerned with one application, essentially, which is the transport in very narrow or confined geometries. As a matter of fact, it turns out, so we're talking about thin plates or thin tubes, where plates is confinement in one dimension, transport in two, and tube is confinement in two dimension, one-dimensional transport. And it turns out that actually the application how actually you do this is rather different in those two cases. And so the application we have in mind for thin plates is the semiconductor application, whereas the application we have in mind for thin tubes has to do with ion channels. And as I said, they look somewhat different in practice, and so I'm going to talk about them in the end. So this is my first part, which is the general principles. And I should say this was general work started by Pierre Degon and Florian Mehatz from Toulouse and myself, and has been extended by a variety of people, and I will mention that as I go along. The basic idea is to say what is a local equilibrium. And to define the local equilibrium in analogy to the classical mechanics case as a maximum of a given entropy functional under constraints. And the constraints are that you have given observations or moments of that functional. And so you basically define the local equilibrium as the solution of a constrained optimization problem. When you do that and you translate that into the language of quantum mechanics, you basically have a general principle which allows you to derive quantum hydrodynamics by virtue of moment closures or by use of BGK operators. So basically, you get a generalization of what's called the Livermore closures in classical mechanics. And by using BGK operators, you arrive at various usual type of diffusion approximation. So this is the general setup. We have something describing the states, which we call S. And we have a function as a density of these states. We have macroscopic observations, which we call kappa, which are usually going to be moments of some sort, or diagonals, or traces. And we have a functional of these on these states, which we call the entropy, which usually there is a probabilistic definition for it, which is the entropy is sort of the information, the incremental information you gain by observing the system and then making one additional experiment or one additional measurement. Now, the local equilibrium, as we see, is defined as, given a certain set of macroscopic observations, find the function which maximizes the entropy under these constraints. Okay? And this is the problem in formulas. So we have entropy, we have constraints, and M, which we will call the generalized Maxwellian, is the maximizer depending on these macroscopic observations. Now, like always, you can, this is standard, reformulate the constraint optimization problem into a non-constraint optimization problem by introducing Lagrange multipliers, and physically, these Lagrange multipliers take the form of chemical potentials. I should point out, of course, that you not only have one observation, you have a vector of observations usually. So M is vector values and lambda is of the same dimension. So just to relate this to the classical case, in the classical case, you have the state given by velocity or momentum. You have a density function of this momentum. You have observations, which are the moments of this density function. You have, in the most simple case, the von Neumann entropy, so which is an integral given of that form. You write down your constraint optimization problems. You differentiate this with respect to F and with respect to lambda to get an unconstrained problem. And if you differentiate with respect to f, you get that the logarithm of f has to be a polynomial of those variables. And it has to, if you differentiate with respect to the Lagrange multiplier, it has to satisfy the constraints. So you get that f, the logarithm of f, is a polynomial. So the Maxwellian is the exponential of a polynomial, which is the classical Maxwellian you get with the chemical potentials. Now, quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, you have a density matrix. So your state is given by two spatial variables and their correlations. You have observations. Observations are self-adjoint operators. And you build the trace of a self-adjoint operator with this density matrix. You have an optimization problem of the same form. So that this unconstrained problem with the Lagrange multiplier, this functional becomes maximal under the constraints. And so you go through the same program, and there is a slight complication now, namely, the complication is that in the classical case, we were dealing with the derivative of a function, and now we have to solve as an equation for the derivative of the Fréchet, for the Fréchet derivative of the density operator.
What's
g of f? G of f, well, g of f is whatever you like it to be. It's a convex functional. Think of it as the trace of the logarithm times f of that operator. Okay? Okay. But it generally has to be a convex functional on the space, whatever it is. I tried not to be too specific on that because there is a very general concept behind it. So the basic, to reiterate what I just said, we have to solve an equation for that Fréchet derivative. And the basic tool here is a theorem which tells you the following. Take a function little g from the reals in the reals that induces canonically an operator, nonlinear operator g, via the spectral decomposition. So if you decompose the operator capital F into its eigenfunctions and eigenvalues, psi are the eigenfunctions, mu are the eigenvalues, n might be discrete or continuous, doesn't really matter. Then the g of f is given by just applying that real function g onto the eigenvalues. And then you can do the following. You can take two derivatives. Namely, you can take the Fréchet derivative of that nonlinear operator g, or you can take the derivative of the function little g in R1. And the theorem says that both things are the same. Well, that's actually not quite true. They're only the same if taking the trace. So in other words, I can either take the Fréchet derivative of capital G and take the trace against the test function, or I can take the derivative of little g and take the trace. Okay. So this is the basic underlying theorem, which is essentially a linear algebra or operator theory theorem. And if you take this, then you have, as in the classical case, that the local equilibrium in the quantum mechanical case is essentially the following. It is Lagrange multipliers times the observation operators, taking the, in the sense of the theorem before, the inverse of the entropy production rate of G prime. That is the definition of a local Maxwellian, subject to the constraint that, there should be an M here actually, that it satisfies the moment equations. So if you take the von Neumann entropy, then G of F is as it is before. Now G is, capital G is now the corresponding trace of the operator function. And you get, of course, the G prime inverse is the exponential. So generally, then you start in a transport picture, you start with the Schrödinger equation, where this is the usual commutator and epsilon is the usual energy. And you take moments of this equation, so you take the expectation of the trace of kappa with that equation, which gives you an evolution for the moments. And you close the moments by this Maxwellian given as the inverse, or the exponential in that case, of Lagrange multipliers times the observation operators. So this is basically the generalization of what's in classical mechanics called the Levermore closures to the quantum mechanical case, because you can take any kind of observation operators you choose and put them in there. You can go to diffusion approximations in the same way by using BGK approximation operators. So BGK operators means that I define a collision operator as a relaxation operator against such a Maxwellian, and the Maxwellian is defined such that the moments M of F has the same moments as, or the same observations, macroscopic observations, as the original function F. And then you go and you play the usual game. You go to a diffusion time scale for small relaxation times and do some kind of diffusion approximation, long-term averaging, Chapman, Enskog, etc. And you get drift diffusion, depending on what you chose as your conserved variables, as your observation operators, you get a quantum drift diffusion system, quantum energy transport system, quantum spherical harmonic expansion models, etc., etc., etc. So this is a general principle. And of course, the general principle, the devil here lies in the detail, because in this general principle, it still involves the evolution of the exponential of the evaluation of the exponential of an operator, and how to compute that in more than one dimension is not that simple.
Can you guarantee that you maintain positivity?
Yes.
Because there is a problem in the Levermore. Even pointwise positivity is a problem in that.
Oh, you mean, can I guarantee positivity of the density matrix? No, not in general. Because for that, it would have to be of this, what Anton said, this Lindblad form, and it's generally not.
It's not. You can prove it's not.
I can't prove it is, but it's not. Okay, now, as I said here, the devil...
Lindblad. What is the equivalent to Lindblad in this setting? Isn't it enough to say that the operator is monotone?
No. It is a Lindblad is a special algebraic form of the operator,
right,
which guarantees that the operator is positive as an operator. So that means the spectral decomposition is only positive.
Yeah, exactly.
So what would be for this sort of BGK structure, even if you do the BGK for relaxation, but only conservative?
What do you mean? What's the answer? What can I prove?
Right. What is the equivalent condition for the quantum system?
No, the condition on the Lindblad operator is that it is of a certain sort of quadratic form, that it's basically twice a transport operator multiplied.
Well, but that depends on the fact that you have over time. But here
Anton finagled his collision operators to be of that form. I don't really know how to do that with a BGK operator. Okay, so that is an open problem, right? So, but what I wanted to say is here that this is the general outline, the general concept, and you can get quantum drift diffusion, quantum energy transport, etc., etc. The devil is in the details, because you have to make some kind of approximation to the equations. And so, for instance, what we try to do is we try to do quantum hydrodynamics in three dimensions with three conserved variables, and we try to do the order h bar squared approximation to that. And the momentum equation would have in scalar form about 640 terms. Okay, so nobody's going to use that. So you have to make various forms of simple approximations, and there is a variety of things people have done. And these are the authors of various papers which derive various approximations in various forms to this, which are actually practically usable. That's not the topic of my talk. The topic of my talk is really to a specific application of this, which is geometry, is transport in thin tubes or thin plates. So on this slide, I have sort of generalized the principles with the physical principles underlying this, and the rest will then be just translating this into some kind of mathematical language. So we think of something which has a small extension in a confinement direction and a large extension in a transport direction. We think of something where the confinement is given by confinement potential, And that confinement potential is very strong compared to the potential driving the transport. Okay? So we will choose collision operators, which basically model physically the collision with some kind of background, either phonons or water in the case of ion channels. And due to this geometric situation, we will get an energy dissipation, but the energy dissipation is going to be anisotropic, which is basically going to be a scaling argument. So the energy tensor is going to relax differently in the different components. And that leads to diffusion equations in subspaces, in eigenspaces of a part of the operator, which is generally referred to as subband modeling. Okay, so this is doing, so these are the formulas saying this. So we take a macroscopic variable x, split it into a component little x, little y. Originally it's in R3, so x is in R dx, y is in R dy, and this x is we call the transport direction and y is the confinement direction. In the case of a plate, the transport is two-dimensional, confinement is one-dimensional. In the case of a tube, it's the other way around. And the point is we have a small geometry, so we have a thin plate or a thin tube. That means the diameter of the omega y domain is much smaller than the diameter of the omega x domain. So for a thin plate, we basically have an application which I'm going to explain this on the next slide, which is SOI, semiconductor devices and thin tubes. The application which we have in mind would be ion channels. Okay? So that's an SOI device, which is sort of one of the new standards of this whole semiconductor industry, which basically has four contacts here in blue, so the particle flows from here to there. And it has insulators marked in yellow. And it has two contacts, a ground contact and a gate contact. And you basically can have a particle flow from here to here, which you modulate by applying a bias from here to here. This thing is, of course, grossly out of proportion. The actual device looks more like that, but then you couldn't read the thing very well anymore. So this is a thin plate, confinement in one dimension, transport in two. Well, it's really 3D, but that dimension you most of the time assume as infinite.
It's homogeneous in the green part. The yellow is insulated.
Well, there is a doping in there, too.
Ah, okay.
There is a doping in there, too, yes. Then the other application we have in mind is a thin tube, which is basically, this is my simplified schematic of it. This is a protein which has certain charges marked in red here sitting on the protein, and there is an ion trying to go through that protein. And it has to find its way confined by these charges sitting around it. And of course, the difference here is that the transport here is one-dimensional, the confinement is two-dimensional. Of course, this is not a straight line, but it's going to be a path. And this is a gross simplification. The actual protein looks more like that, where I hope you can see this, there are little reds and blue dots which denote all these charges on the protein. This is the protein. This is the membrane. There's all these little red and blue dots sitting on the protein, and the ion has to kind of somehow wiggle through this structure. Okay? So, strong confinement, what do I mean by that? Well, it's a matter of how to put it into a formula. The way we do this is the following. So, first of all, what it means is that the y gradient of the potential is much larger than the x gradient of the potential. And it's sort of most appropriate to split this by splitting the potential into its averages in the y direction and into the rest. So V0 is only a function of x, and V1 has a mean of 0 in the y direction for every given x. And strong, and the V1 is a function of a fast spatial variable in y, and the strong confinement means that V0 is of the same order as V1. So V1 has the same kind of potential drop, but over a much smaller distance than V0, which is sort of the practical physical regime. So that basically you go into a scaling argument, rescale the y, split the energy into two parts, one concerning the x direction and the other thing concerning everything else. And that, of course, gives you then two scaled Planck constants, one Planck constant related to the length scale in the x direction, the other one to the length scale in the y direction. So the hx is going to be lambda times hy, essentially. You look at the Schrödinger equation with one of those collision operators, and you see that because of the derivatives, the energy component in the y direction is going to be larger than the energy component in the x direction. So the rest is basically some kind of asymptotics on that structure. And in the end, what is going to happen is, that's why I've written this onto the other side, we're basically going to balance this part with this part. So this is a little bit like the drift collision balance, which was pioneered by Foucault and then, you know, worked out by a variety of people here. Except that we're not going to solve collision problems, we're going to expand them into eigenfunctions in the quantum mechanical case. So now, what to use as collisions operators in a quantum mechanical transport picture is always an issue. Okay? And it's especially it's an issue if you actually want to implement certain physical properties of the collision operator. So what we're going to do is, we're going to take and the beauty of the BGK approximation is that you only need to know two things about the collisions, namely what is conserved and what is dissipated. Okay? So we're going to look at the classical picture. And in the classical picture, we will have two types of collision mechanisms, namely Ida-Boltzmann, which has a finite scattering frequency and the concept of a mean free pass, and this results in this kind of integral equation for the collisions, which is the preferred collision operator in the case of semiconductors. And the other one is Brownian motion, where you have a zero mean free path, an infinite scattering frequency, but infinitesimally small pushes of the particle. And that is used usually in ionic channel to model the interaction with the background water. Okay? So that leads then, of course, in a long timescale averaging, leads to a Fokker-Planck type, classical Fokker-Planck type approximation. Now, if you compute in this scaling the energy relaxation, you will see the following, that this operator, no matter whether it's Boltzmann or Fokker-Planck, is going to dissipate energy. So this is going to be negative. And, however, in that scaling, it turns out that it mainly dissipates the energy in the free transport direction, whereas the energy in the confinement direction is in first order conserved. Okay. So what we're going to choose as our approximation of, as our BGK operator is an operator which conserves mass, obviously, and the energy in the confinement direction, and dissipates a certain entropy, say the von Neumann entropy, which means the Maxwellian is an exponential. Okay? So, now once you've done that, you go through this classical idea of what's called sub-Mann approximations, which means that you basically take the whole transport equation and expand the whole thing into eigenfunctions of the energy Hamiltonian in the confinement direction. That means, and then you go to a semi-classical limit for the Planck constant in the transport direction to zero, which means you basically say that the transport behaves more or less classical in the transport direction, but stays fully quantum mechanical in the confinement direction, which is much smaller. So this is the formulas or for it. So you take eigenfunctions W alpha. You have to assume that the Hamiltonian is self-adjoint and that you have basically a self-adjoint including the boundary conditions, which means essentially that you have a closed system in the confinement direction. There is nothing flowing out there. Then you have real eigenfunctions here and an orthonormal real eigenvalues and an orthonormal eigenfunction system. And you take the rest. And the eigenfunctions, note that the eigenfunctions are still dependent, the eigenfunctions, the eigenvalues are still dependent on the transport direction here. So you have to expand then your density matrix into basically, so this is why the algebra gets very complicated, because you have to have a parameter expansion in two variables. So you have a function, an expansion coefficient u, which depends on the correlation between the two spatial variables, as well as the correlation between the two eigenspaces. Yeah? So you have this double expansion, and you get a rather monstrous transport equation after expansion, where this has to be read in the following way. So u alpha alpha prime of x and x prime is the expanded density matrix coefficient. The purple part is what's left of the transport in the x direction, which actually hasn't changed. The blue part is what's left of the transport in the y direction, which is basically just the commutator with the energy, which is not just the eigenvalue of the Schrödinger equation, which we have to compute. And the red part is what couples the eigenvalues. Okay? So note that the upper line of this equation is diagonal. In other words, the equation for u alpha alpha prime only depends on alpha u alpha alpha prime. Whereas this part, and also this part, as it turns out, couples all the eigenspaces together. Because here I have all the different off-diagonal terms. Okay? So the C alpha beta are the coupling operators, and they are really what are expressed in the notion of strong confinement. Because they're of this form. So they are a first degree differential operator, and they depend on the x derivative of the eigenfunctions in the y direction, okay, in this form, in the sort of usual commutator form. And these eigenfunctions are, of course, the eigenfunctions of the eigenvalue problem of the energy in the y direction. Now, for weak confinement, remember, weak confinement would mean that the forces in that direction would be of the same size. That means the V1 is something which has an order one derivative, and it varies only of a length scale of order O of lambda. It has mean zero, so that means it's of lambda. So for a weak confinement, we could neglect the V1. If we neglect the V1, we neglect the coupling operators, and if we neglect the coupling operators, we get a diagonal equation, which we could then solve just for the diagonal element. Okay. This is the standard physics approach, and then you let Hx go to zero, and you get various diffusion approximations, etc., etc. Now, and there is a whole bunch of literature in the physics as well as in the mathematical literature, starting from the 60s or something. However, in the cases we are interested in, that's precisely not the case. And it's precisely not the case if I give you this example, which was, if you remember, this SOI structure. And if I compute a self-consistent potential in the classical case for this SOI structure, it looks like that. So here is the source, here is the drain contact, here is the gate, here is the bulk contact, and you have some kind of structure. So here, look, these are the corresponding potentials V0 and V1. So this is the average the previous picture over the y direction, and that's what's left. So this function is the v1, which has zero mean in that direction. And if you have that, you can compute the eigenfunctions corresponding to that. And I want to point out this v0 does only influence the eigenvalues of the eigenvalue problem, whereas this really gives the eigenfunctions. So this v0, since it's independent of x, just shifts the spectrum up and down, and this really gives the structure of the eigenfunctions. So if we neglect this, we get zero coupling. However, if we don't neglect it and we use this with realistic numbers, we get these coupling coefficients A alpha beta. To remind you, they were dependent on the x derivative of the eigenfunctions in the y direction, integrated in a commutator out in a commutator fashion. So this is, of course, anti-symmetric. So this picture is minus this picture. Anti-symmetric in the index alpha beta. And of course, the diagonal is zero. The point is, they do not become smaller, okay, for three eigenvalues, for the first three eigenfunctions. So what you have to do then is, well, the next thing is, of course, to put in the collision operator. And so now you get this expanded, complicated animal of transport equation. And what makes it useful is to put in a collision operator, which has only this limited anisotropic energy realization, and go to a diffusion scaling. So this means that since that Maxwellian only depends on the energy in the y direction, if I expand that Maxwellian in terms of the eigenfunctions in the y direction, it's diagonal. Okay? So since it's diagonal, you get basically something which relaxes the system against the diagonal matrix. Okay? So you have these two mechanisms in the problem. One is the coupling, and the other one is the relaxation against the diagonal system. If you play this right and balance the scales, you basically can get then sort of the classical diffusion approximation for transport equations, and that's what we're going to do. So we do actually it's a Hilbert expansion, really, on that, and get that U alpha alpha prime is in first order a diagonal element, and then in second order of order lambda, or in zeroth order and first order, I should say, something that couples. And so you have an equation for U0, which is the diagonal element. And this is given in terms of the transport applied to U1. And the U1, you get the similar sort of game, namely the operator applied to the diagonal element and the transport operator on the collision operator on the right-hand side. This is, of course, still a terribly complicated system because you do need all those alpha alpha primes U1 in order to compute the solution for actually that equation. So it's really not solvable in a sense. You can write it down with pencil and paper, but nobody's going to use that equation. However, now you can go to the semi-classical limit. And in the semi-classical limit involves the usual sort of game people play in this, namely going to Wigner transforms and then letting the Hx go to zero in this. So except that you don't have Wigner transforms, you have Wigner matrices, which give the correlation between two eigenspaces in the Wigner transform. You do all that, it's a formal calculation, and you end up with what's called the subband drift diffusion equation with, and that's actually the end contribution of this, an interband collision operator. Okay? And this collision operator, or the scattering operator, basically models the transfer from one eigenspace to another eigenspace caused by these extremely strong potentials in the confinement directions. Okay? So otherwise, the diffusion equations are pretty much the same. So you have n alpha is the number density in the eigenspace number alpha, j is the flux. The flux is given as a drift in the diffusion term, where in the diffusion you have the B0 potential and the eigenfunction, so or the eigenenergy here. And so what's important here is this Q. And the Q is given in terms of those coupling coefficients with some kind of nonlinear expression. Here it is again. There's a point here. Q is not a classical scattering operator because it doesn't do scattering. It expresses transfer between eigenspaces. So therefore, Q cannot be written as a gain in the loss term, but it's a more complicated thing. However, it's nonlinear. It has the right properties properties as far as conservation, equilibrium and entropy is concerned, because you then can prove the following theorems about the system. And the theorems is, first of all, that's sort of a triviality, but it's not. Namely, that Q conserves locally the mass. Well, obviously because we originally conserved local limit mass, but Q conserves local limit mass no matter how many approximations I take, no matter how many eigenspaces I take. This is a closed system for an arbitrary number of eigenfunction expansions. Okay. So the kernel is given by what it should be, namely some modulation in the x direction and the Boltzmann distribution in the energy direction. And you can, of course, this is a sort of an obvious consequence of the collision operator. It dissipates an entropy, which is the right entropy. Now, what's really sort of from a physics point of view, the relevance here is that we have introduced the concept of an equilibrium into the subband equations. And the equilibrium means that the distribution among the eigenspaces is given by e to the minus energy. Now, in the original subband equations, where they don't have this concept, they have to put this in there via the boundary conditions. And that's sort of a physical undesirable thing to do, because then you have to say that's what happens in the bath, then you have to define what transport is like in the bath, and you have to define what is the what is the boundary between the bath and the equations. This here builds it into the equation. From a physics point of view, that's sort of the relevant, the most important part. I just conclude that part with some numerical results on this plate structure. So to remind you, here's the plate. What you see here is these are calculations with three different bands. So the solid line is the, so these are densities, number densities for band number 1, 2, and 3, and for the total sum. The one line, I think the solid line is without the coupling, and the dashed line is with the coupling. These are the corresponding fluxes. No, the dashed line is without the coupling, I take it back. So the flux is without the coupling, without the collision operators in 1D are, of course, constant in the x direction. And those are the corresponding fluxes in each of the subbands. Their sum is, of course, constant again because of the mass conservation. And you can see that actually these are physically relevant numbers. There is like a 100% difference in the fluxes due to the scattering here, right? So now, so this was all work which is maybe by now like 2 years old or so. And so then we had this idea of, since we have this general methodology to look at transport in confined structures, let's do this not in a two-dimensional, in a one-dimensional confinement, but a two-dimensional confinement. There are some additional complications here, which have to do with the number of confinement dimension. And so in order, this I should say this is joint work with Degond and Ben Abdallah again. In order to give you the background on that, you have to, in order to put this into context, let me give you the background on this simulation. So if you go to these conferences where people are simulating ion channels, there's basically three groups of people, okay? The first one, The first one do molecular dynamics, okay? So that means that they include the water in the background. This is a huge calculation involving massively parallel machines, and they can do this over very short time scales, nanoseconds. Then they say, then there is the Monte Carlo type people who say, okay, collisions with the water, with the background is Brownian motion, we only do the ions and the channel. And they can do longer scales, but still on the order of 10 to 20 nanoseconds, which is three orders of magnitude below on what the channel, what the function of the channel actually is like. And then there are the people who do drift diffusion in the channel with heuristic potentials, okay? Which is, of course, they can do long time scales, but basically you model the channel as a bath, which is a terrible approximation as far as the modeling goes. So this was supposed to be some kind of compromise. Now, there's a bit of a problem here, because if you think of what we've done is, we've done Chapman Anscombe in the transport direction. What that really does is it integrates out the wave vector components in the energy dissipated in the transport direction. So if we have originally a six-dimensional problem, we've reduced it to, for the plate, to a four-dimensional problem, because we've integrated out two components. For the tube, it's harder because we only have one component which we integrate out. So we reduce the six-dimensional to a five-dimensional problem, which is not that dramatic, okay? So we haven't really done this, but we've done it in the classical approximation. So now I have to apologize to the organizers because by now this has nothing to do with the topic of the conference anymore because this is now completely classical. But I thought I'd show it to you anyway. And what we've done is we've basically replaced that potential by a harmonic potential in Y, which gives surprisingly good results. So what we do is we take that original potential V1 and replace it by piecewise by quadratic in the Y direction with coefficients depending on X. And we compute these coefficients such that we optimize or approximate optimally the L2 norm of the functions in the confinement direction, go to the classical limit, and use this sort of channel. Actually, that's not really the channel I use. The channel I use is more of a simplified version like that, which is a transport direction. And there is 100 charges placed randomly across that transport direction. So this is a view through the channel, if you like. This is just for this picture to see what's in the foreground, what's in the background.
No, but in the right side.
No, but that the black ones are in the foreground, the red ones are in the background.
Okay.
Left and right. Okay. So this is just to to be able to see something in this picture. This is the approximation potential. So the left one and those two are potentials which are computed from a full Coulomb potential with all the charges. And those two are the piecewise quadratic approximations. Okay? You see, so these are quadratics for each x, for each slice here. Okay? And you see this is a marvelous approximation. This is for different slices in the third direction. A better calculation is that, which is you do just f equals ma, you just solve the Newton equations for certain trajectories, and once solve them with the full Coulomb potential and once solve them with the harmonic approximation. And you see that without collisions, and you see that these trajectories, they actually stay pretty well together. The point is, if you do that, you can go to a classical limit, and you have to believe that. Well, a classical limit means hy to 0, which means that the alpha, the energy, becomes a continuous variable. Now you get a diffusion equation in energy, or something like that. And for these harmonic potentials, you can actually compute the coefficients. And so I'll conclude with an example for an ion channel and the density. So this is the particle density. This is the channel coordinate. Starts at 0, ends at 500. This is the energy direction. This is a contour plot of that. So this is supposed to show here that this is certainly not a Maxwellian structure out here. And the final picture is going to be this, which is the ion temperature computed. And you see the ion temperature, of course, in drift diffusion would be a constant. And you can see that you have it's not as dramatic as with electrons because ions are heavier, but it's a rather significant 50% difference. So this is it. I'll let you, since I'm already over time, I'll let you read the rest. So basically, this is just a summary of what I've said. Let me just say one thing. What are the open problems? Well, the open problems is this is all purely formal. So you have to you should really prove that this is all true. Well, this is all true, what I said. And of course, the other one is basically a computational problem. So what's lacking is really full 3D quantum mechanical simulations, which we're going to work on. Thank you.